It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, if you're looking for a low-budget hobby with some potential mental health benefits, writing could be just the thing for you. From poetry to memoir, we'll talk about the power of a writing habit with a UW-Green Bay professor. First, over the past several months, and especially since last week's election, conservatives have been flocking to social media platforms more in line with their thinking. They say Twitter and Facebook have suppressed their freedom of speech by blocking or labeling posts from President Trump and his supporters that contain unsubstantiated claims. Facebook and Twitter say they're trying to limit the spread of misinformation. One alternative platform, Parler, says in its community guidelines that it won't decide what content would be removed or filtered based on the opinion expressed in a post. Since Monday of this week, Parler has been the most downloaded free app through Apple's App Store and Google Play. Among those taking to Parler and other sites like MeWe, Gab, and Rumble are extreme right-wing groups like Proud Boys and neo-Nazis that spread conspiracy theories, racist memes, and other toxic content. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you use any of these more conservative-leaning social media outlets? What kind of things do you see there? Do you think Facebook and Twitter are right to label or limit the reach of what it considers a fake news or misinformation, or do you think that's an overreach? What kind of policing, if any, do you think social media platforms should have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Libby Hemphill is an associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Information. Her research areas include social media, political communication, and civic engagement. Libby, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Can you give us a sense of the players here, the sites that are, I think, are not new? They've been around in some cases for a couple of years now. But tell us, what are some of the sites that are getting more attention after Election Day?
Sure. I think the site that's getting the most attention after Election Day is Parler, which is pitching itself sort of as a Twitter replacement. But some other players in the space here are MeWe, which is a sort of anti-Facebook platform, Rumble, potentially Gab, though I haven't heard as much about that lately. They were more a couple of years ago, but alternatives to YouTube and Twitter and Facebook, with Parler the biggest player this week.
How much of a move do you see to these sites in the week since the election?
So I think that the growth numbers that the sites are reporting are quite high, but I think it's kind of a misnomer to say move, because one of the things that's true about social media is that your use can be additive. So you don't have to leave Facebook to join MeWe, and you don't have to leave Twitter to join Parler. You can be on all of them. So it's more of an expansion than a move, though there are some folks pitching an exit from Facebook for tomorrow, as I understand it. So maybe that will be a movement. But I see it more as folks are adding an additional platform more than they're moving from one to another.
And while a lot of these things are being downloaded now, maybe in part by conservatives looking to add or move, and I think a lot from journalists looking to see what's happening on these sites, and probably researchers too, on when you look at the scale of Twitter and especially of Facebook, are we talking about big numbers here?
No, not at all. I think so there were 2.7 billion active Facebook users last month. And the biggest max exit event that I could find had about 75,000 people. That's really nothing to Facebook. It's not even a meaningful fraction of a percent of the folks on Facebook. And when you talk about even 700,000 users moving at a time, that starts to get interesting, but it's not threatening to Facebook or to Twitter anyway.
Talking to Libby Hemphill with the University of Michigan School of Information, looking at alternative social media sites, some billing themselves explicitly as more conservative sites, inviting people to add them into their mix instead of Facebook or Twitter, or maybe make the move entirely. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts about these sites, or your experiences if you've checked them out, and your thoughts on the role of social media platforms like the Facebooks and Twitters and more when it comes to the spread of information. Should they be flagging stories? Should they be blocking the spread of stories? Join in at 800-642-1234. And Libby, let's get to that question about the role of Facebook and Twitter in the spread of misinformation, a big topic. What do you think, what role do you think they should be playing in the midst of this post-election time?
Mm-hmm. I think that the size and scale and speed with which information travels on those platforms mean that their responsibilities are different, and that Facebook and Twitter do have responsibility to help their users be critical consumers of the information that they encounter. I think that the flagging, especially on Twitter, has sort of become more of a story than the flag, than the content that was flagged itself, which is kind of interesting post-election. But I think that because of, they are designed, both Twitter and Facebook, for information to spread really quickly, that it's hard to get that back. But sort of once something is out there and it's moving, it's very hard to correct it. And so they're taking some initiative by doing the flagging. But I think that if their goal is to reduce the spread, it would be better to make it harder to spread in the first place. But I do think that they have a responsibility here because of their scale and the scope of users and content that travel on their platforms.
Right. One worst case scenario happened with Facebook in particular in the country of Myanmar, where the government and the military in particular had this long running Facebook campaign that they ultimately used to incite and organize a genocide, basically. I mean, how much does that weigh on the minds of a company like Facebook? Like, how do we make sure this doesn't happen on our platform again?
I mean, I think the answer to your question about how much does that weigh is not enough. I think that Facebook hasn't yet really reckoned with what their role was in that state-sponsored genocide. And I think that they're struggling now with the misinformation around election results in the US to understand just how much impact does content that travels on their platform have on our democracy. And I think that there's some hubris that still remains that makes it hard for them to see just how much damage can be done both to democratic institutions and to people and their bodies in the case that you mentioned.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Sandy is with us in Dubuque. Sandy, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Sandy?
On this issue of censorship of places like Twitter and Facebook, the average reading level of the average American at one point was only like the fourth grade level, possibly fifth. So I believe that it's imperative that what you put out there for people to read is the absolute truth. It's not something that you can fool with and have, you know, an educated public.
Sandy, thanks a lot for the call. And I think the people critical of Twitter and Facebook would, of course, disagree with Sandy. They say, hold on, we're grownups. We can evaluate claims ourselves. We shouldn't have our hands held by social media companies. How do we square those two arguments, Libby?
So I think you're right that they would respond with, I don't need a company telling me the truth or how to read something. But I think that the evidence suggests that they do, that people are getting a lot wrong and misunderstanding how voting and elections work in the US, for instance. And so the evidence suggests that folks do need someone helping them interpret the information that they're encountering. And, you know, I don't like to be corrected any more than anybody else does. But it's important that we recognize sometimes when we're wrong or when we've got outdated information. And I think Sandy's comment about reading level is interesting because it is hard for us to understand both the information and the flag. And so sort of watching how they change the wording on these misinformation flags and how they try to be more clear about what does it mean so that folks can understand really quickly what does it mean to flag what the president has said, for instance, as misleading or that it misrepresents something has been interesting to watch evolve.
One of the trickiest things here, though, is that there are a lot of statements like if I say this change to tax policy, whatever it might be, is going to boost jobs. Probably we can go back and forth with dueling data and make a case in either direction. Where do we draw the line between, you know, opinion that you can debate versus just flat out falsehood that a Twitter or Facebook should take action on?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And it's something that we are trying to figure out. At the School of Information, we have a study where we're trying to determine sort of what actions do folks want platforms to take and what ones would make sense, where removing is an option, flagging in the way that we've seen is an option. And I don't know, Rob, if we have an answer yet, except do something, but what that something is and how heavy-handed it ought to be is still unknown. And I think your tax policy example is a great one, because that's tax policy is pretty complicated. And so there isn't an easy answer to what is true or false in that case.
We're looking at the rise in conservative alternative social media platforms. Libby Hemphill is with us, associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Information. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you checked out these sites, things like Parler, MeWe, Gab, other conservative social media platforms? Do you think the big name platforms have gone too far when it comes to blocking or labeling posts from President Trump? Or do you think Twitter and Facebook are being responsible in an effort to stop the spread of false information? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're talking about growing interest in conservative social media platforms, things like Parler and MeWe, especially since last week's election. Users say the more mainstream platforms like Facebook and Twitter suppress conservative speech. Libby Hemphill is our guest, associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Information, and studies social media, political communication, and civic engagement. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Libby, before we go back to callers, it seems like we're pretty good at segregating ourselves off in our own information bubbles in a lot of ways, as it is with Facebook groups and who we follow on Twitter, things like that. If we start to have whole politically separated sites, do you worry that's going to draw us further apart than we already are?
I don't know how much further apart we can get. I worry more about sort of the casual encounters that we have with one another. So I don't worry as much about, like, sort of everybody needs a home where they can go and have conversations that are reinforcing socially, just as a, like, to connect with other people. When that becomes dangerous is when folks are connecting around hatred or discrimination or other sort of socially dangerous ideas and activities. And it is helpful for us to encounter ideas that run counter to our own every once in a while. It's just not helpful for us to be bombarded or threatened by them constantly. So I think we are pretty divided, even in the large platforms.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you. I was going to say that I thought it was a good thing whenever Twitter labels something that is likely to be wrong or false. I see plenty of things that are dishonest or misleading on YouTube still, so I'm sure they're not labeling, at least not aggressively. And some of the things just recently relating to this last election I've seen getting passed around that are not true at all. One example was there's a video guy someone put together intending it for it to be a joke, where he was pulling out what looked like a Trump ballot and tearing it up and claiming he was a postal worker. But if you look at the guy, and he admitted this, he's wearing what he wears when he works at Amazon, which does not handle ballots. And the entire thing was a fake, but people are claiming it was true.
Nate, thanks a lot for that call. And Libby, we're seeing this again and again. I see a story debunked, and then in my informal observation online, I see it spreading days and even weeks after it's been debunked. Does flagging things like that as possible information, as Twitter does, really make a difference?
Well, I think we talked to before the break about how hard it is to catch up with something that's already out there. And I think what you're mentioning is absolutely true and has been my experience too, that once something's out there, it goes fast, and debunking stories don't go fast or far really at all. And that, I think, is part of why the flag that Twitter provides on tweets is making some difference, because it persists. And so if I retweet it, when you go to see it, it shows up. The flag shows up. And so it's doing something, which honestly is better than nothing, which is what we had even 6 months ago. But I don't know that it's a real answer yet, because it is so hard for the debunking story to catch up with the original problematic story.
Thanks, Nate, for calling in. We'll go to Evan now in Ashland. Evan, hello.
Yeah, sort of it's my understanding, like, I am in support of at least what I've seen so far on Facebook and Twitter. If you think about it like it was a traditional brick and mortar store, they say somebody walks in and starts saying something that as the owner you disagree with, you don't have to let them stay in your store and speak to your customers, and you especially don't have to give them a megaphone to make their message louder.
Evan, thanks a lot for the call. They're private businesses, he says, and so they have the right to regulate speech as they see fit, Libby.
And I think that's an argument that I have made as well, that when I hear this sort of argument about, oh, they're threatening the freedom of my speech, but like, it's a private place. You don't actually have the freedom to speak there or to say anything you want, like Evan said. I think the other part of the analogy to the brick and mortar store that matters here is that often if you are being obnoxious in a brick and mortar store, even if you're not bothering the owner, if you're bothering the other people there, the owner is probably going to ask you to leave because it's bad for business. And I think that Facebook especially is starting to see that rampant misinformation and rampant hatred is bad for business. Advertisers don't like it and they don't want to be associated with it. And so if Facebook wants to keep making ad money, then they have to clean up a little bit. And Twitter has been protected from that for a while. But is starting to be more exposed to it as they depend more on ad revenue.
Let's go to Hannah now, calling from Madison. Hannah, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to comment regarding the professor's earlier comments about Facebook's role in the genocide in Myanmar. And I think that, Professor, you have a invalid assumption of good faith with Facebook, that the comment was something like that they're, you know, grappling to understand their responsibility in all of this and democracy. But I think if we look at the history of Facebook's action in the world, we see that they actually are very aware and they're choosing to not do anything about it because there's no incentive for them in the capitalist system. And so I think when we're looking at freedom of speech, like the professor just said in the most recent comment, that Facebook, you know, they'll incentivize freedom of speech if it's profitable for them. If it becomes not profitable for them in the future, then they'll change that. And so while I think it's important to talk about, you know, our rights and what's happening and who's getting heard, I think that any sort of, you know, congressional hearing or anything would just be a slap on the wrist. But the actual incentives aren't changing for the corporation.
I gotcha, Hannah. Thanks a lot for the call. Hannah's saying, follow the money with Facebook. Don't assume that they're a good actor, Libby.
I think Hannah's right. I think that makes a lot of sense. And that what I mentioned earlier is that they haven't really learned. And I think that I'm more bullish now on their ability to have a better moral compass than they have had in the past. But Hannah's right that they are a profit motivated company and they're going to make profit motivated decisions.
Thanks for the call, Hannah. Talking about Facebook and Twitter and new conservative leaning social media outlets with Libby Hemphill, professor at the University of Michigan School of Information. Our next caller is Jim, calling from Two Rivers. Jim, hi.
Hey, great show today, as always.
Thank you.
I'm a bit of a conservative, not too much, but I wonder if we would be having this conversation if we had had a normal president in the last 4 years. You know, it's been, we've had technology, we've had social media, but also I wonder if we had a newspaper that was as powerful as Facebook, it would have been broken up by antitrust a long time ago. So I have to think that we're just in the infancy of social media. There's only two platforms. There should be five or six, just like there's five or six or seven good national newspapers. And the young lady who called just now, I so much agree, and I love her, the emotion she has about that. Unfortunately, when we're in the early stages of an industry, especially in media and entertainment, sometimes things get ugly before they settle down.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Interesting thought that we're kind of in the infancy. This is still pretty new in the scope of things, and Jim's hoping to see more effective competition also with the big players, Libby.
Yeah, and I think both Jim and Hannah's comments relate to Facebook, especially as one of the things that companies that are first movers and had some success tend to do is argue that you ought to throw up barriers that would make it harder for other folks to enter. And that's exactly what Facebook is doing when they say that things like content moderation are so expensive that no one could do them but Facebook, that they try to make it even harder for other players to enter the space that they so effectively occupy. And I think it will be interesting to see what happens in Europe, potentially next week in the congressional hearings. And I think it's interesting that at least one of the Democratic candidates early in the primaries had a break 'em up plan that Elizabeth Warren wanted us to talk about, but then it didn't get very far. I think it'll be interesting to see whether there is any movement around competition or in addressing their profit motivations, as Jim and Hannah have mentioned.
In our last minute or so, Libby, what are you watching for next as we look at these conservative sites and whether they're going to replace or supplement the big players for more and more people?
I think it will be interesting to see whether they're able to make any money and if folks actually do move rather than just add. So right now we're seeing similar content posted by the same accounts on multiple platforms. And if it starts to be, especially with Parler, if some of these conservative voices really do leave Twitter and go to Parler, I think that would be interesting. And I think I'm curious about what will happen and whether we will become more divided in the spaces and ideas that we discuss.
Libby, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Libby Hempel is an associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Information. We talked through about a rise in conservative social media sites like Parler, MeWe, and more since last week's election. Coming up after the news, if you're looking for some longer-term stress relief, you might benefit from creating a writing habit. Our guest has some advice on how to get started. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, get some advice on appreciating poetry and maybe even writing your own. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. On a related note, if you're looking for ways to improve your mental health these days, taking up writing might be a good option to consider. Research published in the Journal of the American Medical Association links writing about stressful life experiences to improved health. And you don't have to write about your stress. You could write for other reasons. Some fiction, maybe. Write about your family history, a poem, a journal, whatever it might be. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you ever try to do some creative writing or even journaling? What does it do for you? What have you been writing lately? Have you managed to make it a habit? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tara DePras is a lecturer of English and Writing Foundations at UW Green Bay. Her writing has appeared in such places as The Washington Post, Creative Nonfiction, and Inside Higher Ed. Tara, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, I think a lot of people might hear that and think, oh, writing is great for the writers. I'm not a writer, so this isn't about me. Should we all think of ourselves as at least having the potential to do some writing?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's one of the biggest misnomers about writing. Elizabeth Gilbert has a wonderful book on creativity called Big Magic. And she says, if you're alive, you're a creative person. So I'm here to give everyone who's listening permission to write.
I think, well, one of my thing that holds me back from writing, even if I'm not ever going to show it to somebody else, is, I guess, a self-consciousness. I know I'm not going to be a great writer, so I don't even want to start. How do you overcome that, Tara?
Yeah, I mean, that's something I think everyone faces as writers, professional writers, beginning writers. You know, the first thing really is just to give yourself a sense of permission to write. The other thing you can do is give yourself permission not to write. If you don't have the time or the space in your life right now, you can do it at any time in your life. It's not ballet. You're not going to expire at a certain age. I didn't write for several years when I had my second child because I didn't sleep. So I just didn't have the space, and that's okay. But it's never too late.
There's a lot of variety, of course, in things we can write. We don't have to sit down and write, you know, a Tolstoy-length novel. Can you talk about, I guess, the effort to find which kind of writing might be right for us?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think whatever you choose should be something that you care deeply about. If you care about a topic, you can find a way to write about it, and you can find a medium to write about it. You can write poetry about it. You can work it into a novel. You can write essays, or you can just write privately for yourself in a journal. So what you just need to center the thing that you care about most in the world in your writing.
We're talking to Tara DePrat, lecturer in English and Writing Foundations at UW Green Bay, talking about the benefits and joy of writing and how to get started. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you keep a journal? Do you write poetry for yourself or maybe to share with others? Do you have a novel in the works? Tell us about your own writing story. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Tara, I know you've given a lot of thought to the mental health benefits of writing and writing about maybe tough times in our lives. Can you tell us some of the possible benefits?
Yeah, so I think at a basic level, writing just helps us experience and order the world. It helps us pay attention. It helps us make sense of problems that we might be having in our personal lives or problems that we see in the world. So from a very simple perspective, it does the work of cognitive restructuring, just like talking to a therapist might. But, you know, it's free and it's something you can do privately. Writing can help you relieve stress and anxiety on a very basic level. But it's not just the cathartic effect of writing that is good for you. There's research out there that links writing about stressful experiences to improved health, and this holds true over time. So, you know, as long as you're enjoying it and it, you know, you're not feeling like overwhelmed or whatever, like it's going to help you. It's going to be good for you in the short term and in the long term.
As you said, part of writing is sometimes allowing ourselves not to write. But that said, do you have thoughts on how people who think, yeah, I want to do this and I want to keep myself doing it on at least a somewhat regular basis, how can we get into a habit of writing, whatever kind of writing we choose to try?
Yeah, this is something I think about all the time because I try to teach students how to become writers, and it's something I'm always thinking about for myself as well. I really like the book by Charles Duhigg called The Power of Habit. It's not about writing at all. It's about habits. And he talks about how for any habit formation, there's three elements. There's a cue, a routine, and a reward. And so the routine would be the writing itself. Like, that's the thing we want to try to do more regularly. So if you can create cues for yourself, you can make that easier. And cues can be anything from, like, a cup of coffee or the right music or being in the same place or at the same time every day. The cue helps make the habit automatic so you don't waste mental space arguing with yourself about like what else you should be doing right now or what else you could be doing because you don't feel like writing. You just do it. It becomes automatic. And then the reward is the part that keeps you going. And for me, you know, and I think for a lot of writers, the reward is the writing itself. It's the feeling that you get while you're writing, that state of flow you can enter. Or it can be something more tangible at times, like when I was under a big deadline, I would literally give myself a gold star on my calendar for every hour that I wrote.
Let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234. Kathleen is with us in Gresham. Kathleen, hi.
Hi. I just totally agree that writing is very important. And I used to write to women in prison in Texas, and I'm in Wisconsin. And one of them asked me, would you teach my cellie how to read and write? And I thought, how am I ever going to do that? So I asked her, Sally, to just write whatever she could, put it on a piece of paper, whatever. I didn't care. And she sent me the outline of her hand and the words, here be a hug. And that's one of the most powerful things I've read all my life. And that's one of the, that just hit me. And then I wrote back that somebody could read it to her, that she could just write whatever she felt. And this woman who had failed school, who ended up on drugs, who ended up in prison, wrote me the most beautiful letters when she felt secure enough to write, that no one was judging her. It was just wonderful. So I just encourage everybody to write. So thank you for having this program.
Kathleen, thank you. Wow, what a story. One thing that makes me think, Tara, is you can make an eloquent and powerful statement, even if you don't have a lot of the words necessarily and the writing skills that you might think you need.
Yeah, absolutely. Writing is something that anyone can do. My 4-year-old can do it, and he can just write a few letters. It's a way of putting your consciousness onto the page for yourself to see or to share with others if you choose to do that.
Also, she mentioned the idea of that lack of judgment. Now, if you want to be a professional writer and share things with other people, eventually there's probably going to be some judgment in there. But for those opening stages, or for just writing for ourselves, how do we shut down that judgment that tells us it's not worth it to write this down?
Oh, yeah. The inner critic. That's a powerful force. I think most kinds of writer's block are fear related. They're related to your inner critic. It's the imposter syndrome that's telling you that other people are better than you, so why bother? It's, the voice of maybe your angry mother who wants you to be perfect or something like that. So I think if we can, start to recognize those voices and listen to them, and thank them for trying to protect you from getting hurt, and then wish them well, send them on their way. That's a really wonderful place to start. But just, I think it's important to remind yourself that you have permission to write. And the first attempt at anything is not going to be perfect, right? That's the wonderful thing about writing, is that you have a chance to do it over again. You get to revise.
Thanks for that call. We'll bring on Mike now in Carpentersville, Illinois. Mike, hello.
Hi. I called to say I'm 31. I just started journaling like 4 months ago. Just about the marital stress in my life and any other things that are on my mind. And I found it very cathartic. It's been good.
That's interesting. And Mike, do you go back and read what you wrote, 4 months ago?
Yeah, I do. It's all digital, right on my phone in a locked app. And sometimes I edit it a little to add. But it's good to revisit and see what's changed or gotten better or need to see again.
Mike, thank you so much. And that, Tara, is part of the value I've heard from some people on journaling, to be able to go back and see what their state of mind was 4 months ago or 40 years ago. It's kind of a marker of our current state of mind and how we change over time.
Yeah, absolutely. Another writer that I love, Joan Didion, has an essay called On Keeping a Notebook. And she says, the point is to remember what it was to be me. So it's keeping on terms with your former self and seeing yourself change over time.
Thanks a lot for sharing your journaling story with us. We're talking to Tara DePraw, lecturer in English and Writing Foundations at UW-Green Bay. She's joining us to talk about the writing process, how it can be good for us, and how to get started. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you write for fun, relaxation, reflection, maybe therapy? Have you been wanting to start a writing habit, but you haven't gotten it to stick quite yet? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Tara DePras, lecturer in English and Writing Foundations at UW-Green Bay. She's helping us create writing habits of our own, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Cody is with us in Watertown. Hi, Cody.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what'd you want to tell us about?
So I'm an avid outdoorsman, and it's duck season right now, so I bring my phone out into the blind, and there's lots of time in the morning before you can really do anything. And I've started writing down what I hear, what I see, what's around me, the environment, and trying to write it poetically, like Aldo Leopold or Norm MacLean. And it's just been, like, really nice to, like, look back and, like, reflect on what's happening around me at the moment.
Do you feel, Cody, like you are, I don't know, more connected or conscious of what's going around you when you take that effort to note things and write them down?
Definitely. And I think that's been like a hard time for me. I think I'm an educator as well, so I've been very stressed. And sometimes like when you're really stressed, doing the things you love is hard to do, but you need to like keep doing them. And writing for me has helped me to like connect more with nature and like those things that I do love and enjoy.
Fantastic, Cody. Thanks for sharing that. Tara, the word that pops into my head there is mindfulness. It sounds like taking these notes about a thing he would have been doing anyways is helping him connect and be conscious of the world around him. And he says it's helping deal with that stress. What do you think?
Yeah, I think of writing as a kind of a meditation at times. And I often tell myself and students as well, like, if you don't know what to do or what to write, start with description. Because it helps you to focus, to slow down, to pay attention, to connect with the world around you. And doing it out in nature is one of the absolute best ways to do that. Deep descriptive writing is what's going to help you find your subject, the thing that you really care about. And it's going to help you find your writing voice, too.
Cody, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Deborah joins us next in Brown Deer. Deborah, hello.
Hello. I have a phone appointment with a therapist in about an hour, so I took my notepad and I started writing down what I'm going to say to him so I just don't go off on any tangents. And I, as I was doing that, your program came on, and so
wow.
I have to say, I want to hear just about a paragraph. It'll be 1 minute. What I wrote?
Go for it.
So I'm staying at home in my very tiny apartment, trying to figure out where to put my desk, a table, a bed, and books. But since I don't have any of those things, not here at least, I can just imagine where to put them when I do move them here. So it's just like confirming things in my mind of what's going to happen. But just to formalize like an appointment, I've always loved writing. I'm not trying to be a professional and write a book, but that would be nice someday.
Deborah, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that story. Collecting her thoughts, using writing, Tara, to collect her thoughts, in this case before meeting with her therapist, a very, very direct mental health benefit there, I think.
Yeah, so two things really struck me about what Deborah said. One, she talked about trying to avoid tangents. And, you know, I'm actually a big fan of tangents. I think that writing gets really interesting when you follow the tangents. It might help you get to the thing that you wanted to say all along that you forgot about or didn't think you should talk about. And the other thing that I really liked was this idea of imagining. A big part of writing absolutely is imagination. I think a lot of writers start with their lived experience, which is a great foundation. But then, you know, taking the leap into imagination helps you imagine other lives, other possibilities. So those are great skills for writers.
Deborah, thanks for calling in and sharing that with us. We are talking about writing with Tara DePras from UW-Green Bay. She says we can all probably benefit from writing, and we could pick the style and how much we want to put into it. Back to your calls now. AJ is with us in Green Bay. AJ, hello.
Hey there, guys. How you doing?
Good. What you want to tell us about AJ?
Okay, here's the story. My brother-in-law, a few years ago, when he was doing his master's in teaching, he had to write a paper. And in his studies, he had come across that the art of writing forces your brain to hold a thought pattern, because you can think so much faster than you can write. It holds that thought pattern as you get the words and stuff down on paper. And he said it was an excellent way to help ward off the effects of, like, Alzheimer's and all these other diseases, because it's the most taxing for your brain.
Interesting, AJ. I'd never heard that, Tara. Have you heard that it's really good brain exercise?
You know, I haven't heard anything about, like, Alzheimer's in particular, but I do think of writing as a kind of exercise for your brain. I think the more you do it, the easier it gets. It becomes like it's a muscle, essentially. And so, like anything, if you practice, it gets easier. And that kind of ties back to the habit thing we were talking about. You know, I think even if you only write one sentence a day or one paragraph a day, or you do it 3 times a week, the quantity is less important than the habit. Even if it's tiny, if you do it consistently, it will get easier.
Thanks for that call. Bob joins us now in Lake Geneva. Hello, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What have you been writing, Bob?
Well, I wrote a book called What a Ride. I'm 79 years old. I wrote the book about 5 years ago. And just my life experiences. We've been married for 60 years, and we raised 8 children, and we had 12 foster kids, and it was just all of these different people like into our life and my different jobs and fundraising. And I was on the board for a homeless shelter in Kenosha called the Shalom Center. And we were also working with a orphanage in Honduras. And I decided to raise money for both of those. So I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro.
Wow. Okay.
And raised $50,000. So we took $25,000 and gave it to each one of the orphanages. So just little things like that. We're talking about our magnificent marriage. My wife and I met each other in fifth grade.
That's great. Bob, your line's breaking up a little. I'm sorry, but thank you so much for sharing that. And Tara, I've had family members doing not a whole book like Bob did, but, you know, answering, there's websites where you can answer prompt questions and write little essays about things you've done in your lives. And I got to say, having some family members who are genealogists, Bob's book is going to be pure gold for them down the road. Just taking our life experiences and putting them to paper could be pretty rewarding, can't it?
Yeah, it's a wonderful way to leave a legacy for your family as well, to have that record. My grandfather was a World War II veteran. He fought in the D-Day battle, and he recorded an oral history that's in the D-Day Museum in New Orleans, and he's not with us any longer, and so it's really wonderful to have that story captured, and we have it in print as well.
Bob, thanks so much for that call. I appreciate it. In our last, little less than a minute, Tara, can you leave us with maybe a prompt if somebody feels inspired to try something tonight?
Oh, okay. You're putting me on the spot here. Yeah,
yes.
Prompts are wonderful. I mean, first, you can find them everywhere. I love the Poets and Writers magazine and online for writing prompts. One of the first prompts that I give to students at the beginning of our Intro to Creative Writing class is called the 1-inch picture frame. It comes from Anne Lamott's book, Bird by Bird. And the idea is all you have to write is what you can see in a 1-inch picture frame. So it could be a literal photograph that you have hanging up somewhere that's meaningful to you, or it can be an idea that's in your mind. But if you can frame it within 1 inch and start with descriptive detail and describing the image, that will eventually lead you to a larger narrative of, you know, what else is going on that you can't see in that 1-inch picture.
All right. Take it away, listeners. Tara, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Tara DePraz is a lecturer in English and Writing Foundations at UW Green Bay. She joined us with some inspiration about the benefits of writing. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Wisconsin's one of the hardest hit states in the country right now in the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll find out how the state compares to others in the region and different approaches state leaders are taking. That plus Food Friday, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Do you have that one little thing when you cook that adds a lot to your cooking in general or to a particular dish? That's our topic tomorrow on Food Friday. I hope you'll join in with me and executive producer Judith Sears Poisson. It will be her last day here at WPR before she moves on to a new line of work. And it'll be the last in a fun series of Food Friday conversations with me, Judith, and with you. You can get us started right now with your small cooking hints that make a big difference. Email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Maybe it's a favorite spice that you add into a lot of dishes or a special sauce, store-bought or homemade. Maybe it's putting a fried egg on anything and everything, or it could be measuring garlic by the bulb instead of the clove. Judith and I will share some of our own examples of little things that make a big difference. Spoiler alert, mine will reveal that in some ways I'm not all that bright. Again, we want to hear from you. You can call in tomorrow or you can share your favorites right now by emailing ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Really hoping I can learn some good tips from you along the way. That's tomorrow on Food Friday. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network.